whatever's easier for me to get, whatever errand I have, either in sand or, you know, those little shavings that you kind of have in like a hamster bed or a guinea pig bed. Those are good as well. And I'm going to store my tubers in there so they're nice and snug. They sort of retain enough moisture. They're not going to dry out, but they're not going to get super wet either. And then I wrap mine in newspaper. They can go in a cool basement, depending on how well insulated a garage is, they could be in there. But the main thing is you just want to make sure they're dry and relatively cool. So you've done a few things. When they're all done, take a walk around your yard. Just take this moment to sort of slow down and look at everything. And first of all, that gives you a chance to celebrate everything you grew over the summer. But it also just gives you a chance to be grateful for anything that you've done, anything that will grow there in the future. It also gives you a chance to spot any pests or disease that need attention now. So always, always, always try and just slow down. You got a lot of things on your list, but just slow down and look around, because if you catch things now, that's going to allow you to use the least toxic method of management. You know your master gardeners can hook you up with any advice, depending on what you find on that slow, grateful garden walk around your space. You can get in touch with us at metromastergardeners.org. And then one more October task. If you harvested seeds, or perhaps you purchased wildflower seeds, you need to do one more thing. You need to look and see if they need a period of cold to be able to germinate. So I talked about this in April's episode. This is called cold scarification, and this is actually pretty typical, especially for wildflowers. They need that sort of freeze-thaw. They need that cold season because they've adapted to use that to actually germinate. So if you saved or you purchased seeds, make sure you do your research, because you're either going to consider scattering them now in the fall, or you're going to need to put them in your fridge and simulate it. So I only say this, I've actually forgotten. I've gotten caught in this. I've gotten very excited. I get very excited about buying plants all the time. I buy seeds. I get to spring. Man, I needed to make sure these had some cold. So you're listening to Garden Party on X-Ray FM on KXRY at 91.1. Live radio, folks, and 107.1 in Portland and 91.7 FM in Nehalem, Manzanita Beach, and Rockaway Beach, streaming online everywhere at xray.fm. We're going to come back after this song from the Beths.
Drying on my cheek, it could be a long wait. I can see strength, but I shrink, it's too dazzling a light ray. I could thin it out, dilution, drip it in my veins till I'm great.
Welcome back to Garden Party on KXRY Portland. That was Best Laid Plans by the Beths. I can't believe it, but there's still tickets left for their November 14th show at the Crystal Ballroom. So get on it, folks. And also get on cleaning those Mason Bee cocoons. If that wasn't on your list for October gardening, I have an interview right now with fellow Oregon State University Extension Master Gardener Ron Spendahl. Hopefully that will convince you to add it. Let's listen.
Welcome to Garden Party. You are such a legend in our community of master gardeners. I'm really grateful to have you today. How are you doing?
Doing fine.
Ron, you are, like me, an extension service master gardener. How long have you been a master gardener?
Since 2002. Well, I've always had a small garden wherever we lived. And then I retired in 2001 and decided that I would try the master gardener program. So I signed up for it. When I became a master gardener, initially I volunteered at the Washington County Fairgrounds where they had a garden. And for the first 2 years, because I had some carpentry skills as well, I did a lot of hardscape kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then thought I needed to get beyond that. So I attended a lecture on Mason bees, and I had more questions than the presenter had answers. So that led me to do a lot of research on my own, and that kind of snowballed into where I am now.
So one thing led to another and another and another. And now I will say how I know you is as one of our, you know, Metro region's, I think, best resources and best experts on Mason bees. So that's very cool that you took those questions and you turned it into such an expertise. Where do you garden now? And is that where you're also caring for bees?
My quote unquote gardening is purely Mason bees.
Oh, so I love it.
This right now, I only have a few sites that I work with. Jackson Bottom Wetlands, which is where I do most of the research projects I do on Mason bees. Portland Community College Rock Creek campus, where there is the education garden that the master gardeners keep. A community garden that's operated by the city of Hillsboro, and then a private farmer. So those are the four that I've got going right now. I've in the past had as many as 23. Different sites, but that became more than a full-time job. I also forgot to mention Jenkins Estate.
Oh, yes. Another incredible public resource and garden. Very cool. Worth the drive to the west side if y'all are listening in from another part of town. So, you know, one thing that I really want to share with listeners is I feel like there has been such great awareness brought to the importance of pollinators, of bees in particular, at least, you know, in the decade or so that I have really become a gardener and gotten interested in this. And I'm really grateful for that. But I also recognize that a lot of what I see out there is around honeybees. And honeybees are, you know, we both know this, they're not native to the U.S. They were brought here, they serve a very important purpose, but they're not native, they're European. So tell us about Mason bees. How are they different than maybe the honeybee that people are more familiar with?
Sure. Like you said, honeybees are not native. Mason bees are native to our area. And basically, there's two categories of bees, social bees and solitary bees. Social bees are like honeybees and bumblebees. They nest in colonies. They have a queen. They have a large number of worker bees to support the hive. Solitary bees, basically the females do all of the work. They build their own nests. They forage to feed their young, and they lay their own eggs. Mm-hmm. So the fact that Mason bees are solitary bees also means that they don't have a very high defensive instinct. They have a very high survival instinct. So as opposed to a social bee like a honeybee, they have a very low survival instinct and an extremely high defensive instinct. So if they perceive you as a threat to the hive, they will obviously attack you and sting you. And a Mason bee is more interested in surviving because she does everything on her own and she doesn't rely upon a colony to work within. So a Mason bee is much more docile to work with. So that makes them easy to work with in environments where there are kids present. I've had a number of nesting stations built on the grounds of elementary schools, and I taught the second graders how to take care of the Mason bees, and those always worked out really well, and we've never had any incident of a two-year-old or, pardon me, a second grader being stung.
So you mentioned the female bee, you know, she's kind of doing it all. She's creating that nest. She's laying her eggs. So what is her life cycle like?
Let's right now, At this point in time, all of the mason bees are in cocoons.
This is October. The bees themselves are in cocoons, or their offspring are?
It's last year's offspring. So
last year's offspring. Okay.
So by June of last year, all of the offspring for last year were starting to cocoon, and they've been in those cocoons since around the first part of June. Initially, they have a period of time that's about 4 to maybe 6 weeks where they are pupating inside the cocoon, and then they become a fully formed adult bee while still in the cocoon. So right now, the cocoons that are in storage have fully formed adult mason bees inside of them. And this is the time of year that we're approaching, where we take the cocoons out of storage and clean them to get the parasites off of them, and to get all the other debris off the cocoons and out of the nesting devices that we use. And so with the clean cocoons, again, we store them in a refrigerated environment to keep them as cool as we can, because the adult bee inside the cocoon is living off of a very tiny speck of body fat. And if their metabolism rate goes up, which it does when they're in a warmer environment, they're using up that little reserve of food too quickly. So it's better to keep them very chilled. I usually keep mine somewhere around 34 to 36 degrees. And then I wait until I start to see things in bloom, which the plant that I use most frequently to give me kind of an indication is Oregon grape. When the Oregon grape gets to be, popped really into bloom, not just the buds, but full bloom, that's usually an indication that things are getting warm enough to put out the cocoons into the nesting trays and mason bee houses. And when the temperature outdoors gets above 55 degrees for like 4 or 5 days in a row, the bees inside will detect the heat. And because they probably used up their food supply, that little speck of body fat, they're also very hungry. So they chew their way out of their cocoons. And then the nesting season begins. Usually the males come out first. Because they need to get out and about and start scouting for females. So the males come out usually about a week or two and before the females start to emerge from their cocoons.
So the males come out first.
And once the females come out, then the mating season begins. The females get mated with very quickly. A male mason bee only lives about 3 to 4 weeks usually. And a female can live about 4 to 6 weeks. So she has a little longer lifespan.
But it's still a very, very short lifespan. So I can see why it's sort of worth helping out a little bit and making sure that this is all working out, because it kind of seems like they have such a short window to get everything done that they need to do to create the next generation. And listeners, if you're not familiar with Oregon grape, if you give it, a quick Google, I guarantee that once you see it once, this is also the Mahonia. There's many, many, many different varieties of it. But once you see a picture of it, you will see it everywhere. You will hopefully notice it everywhere. And, the leaves are almost holly-like, but thankfully they're not holly. A lot of different colors, really spiky, sort of groups of yellow flowers. And so that's what you're going to be looking for in spring. And Ron, I love that idea of, not necessarily timing it to a calendar, because we can't time weather and climate and bloom to a calendar necessarily. But instead of just slowing down and looking around you and looking for that Oregon grape, to fully bloom, and that being a time to bring those cocoons out and then let them do their thing. And so you mentioned that, here in October, this might be a good time of year to clean the cocoons and bring them inside. So tell us what cleaning them looks like.
Cleaning them can look like different things to different people. Okay. A common way of cleaning them is to use water and switch them around into water, and then put them under running water in kind of a sieve device, and then laying the cocoons out on paper towels to make sure they can dry. I've never been a fan of the water cleaning technique, only because during the course of raising mason bees, I go to great efforts to make sure that the cocoons stay dry. Mm-hmm. You don't want them to get wet and stay wet, because they can mold and that will kill the bee inside. So I am a a fan of the dry sand method, which is taking the cocoons and putting them into a device that I built that the cocoons stay in a cylinder of 1/8 inch hardware cloth. And then that fits into a pint-sized mason jar, and you can put about 100 cocoons or so into the cylinder, and then put in a certain amount of dry mason sand. Mason sand's good to use because it's got a lot of grit to it, which is sharp edges on the little grains of sand. Mm-hmm. And then you shake the jar really hard, and the sand goes in and out of the cylinder where the cocoons are, mm-hmm. And basically scrapes off anything adhering to the outside of the cocoon. And the cocoons don't get damaged because they're inside of that cylinder, and so they don't get bashed around a lot.
Ron, how would you describe a cocoon to someone who's not seen one before?
It looks like a latte-colored Jelly Belly jelly bean. It's about that size, and it does have a little bit of a curvature to it, but not much. Mm-hmm. And they're very, very, very lightweight.
If this is interesting to people, and then they want to get into this, how would they get their start?
When I started, basically, I did research on what kinds of things mason bees like to nest in, and then I built some different styles of nesting devices, and I just put them out on mm-hmm. the theory that if I built it, they would come.
Mm-hmm. And did they?
And they did. And then I kind of narrowed down my options on what I thought worked best for nesting devices. But the general public can get cocoons in a variety of ways. They're available sometimes at feed and seed stores. You can get them. There are a couple of good websites that you can get them on, if they are so inclined. On the first Saturday in December, December the 6th, we're doing a cocoon cleaning workshop at Portland Community College, Rock Creek campus, from 10 to noon. And there's no fee for it. It's free. You don't need to register. You just show up. And we'll go through what the processes are that I use to clean cocoons. And I will have brought a number of nesting trays that I will distribute out, and people can clean the cocoons out of the nesting trays and then clean the cocoons with some dry sand in the process. Mm-hmm. That I'll describe, and then they get to keep those cocoons. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So people can get a little supply of cocoons to start with. Also, people show up for that cocoon cleaning workshop and bring their own nesting devices. So there's usually a lot of different kinds of things to look at and to see what works better than others.
Yeah, I definitely have, I think what is traditionally known as that nesting device. So it is that sort of tube-like, straw-like feature. And my cocoons are in there. And that's why I was really, really looking forward to this conversation today, because it's something that I have been doing with my kids. And I knew there was something that I needed to do to keep them healthy. So I may actually come to that workshop and get some guidance on how to get those safely out of there and cleaned and then ready for spring. So I imagine, like you said, they've been, sort of growing all winter. They're going to emerge. They're going to be very hungry. What should we have in our yards for those mason bees to use for their diet when they do emerge?
Basically anything that blooms really early. So like we talked about, Oregon grape. Flowering currants work really well. Flowering heather or heath works well. And they also use trees. So if you have an early variety of apples that bloom early, or big leaf maples, they really like big leaf maples. They also like willow trees. And they will even use early blooming blueberries.
Mm. And what I love about this is, it's a lot of those plants that you really get sort of that double duty from. They're great for the creatures that we share our space with, but they're also gorgeous in our yards. I mean, Mahonia changes colors throughout the year. The big leaf maple is gorgeous in the fall. It adds just a wonderful, wonderful thing to look at in our yard.
Well, a little bit of technical difficulties with that interview, but I feel like you missed the most important part, which is that it's really, really cool hearing about how different mason bees are than bumblebees and honeybees. So we're going to listen to this little song and then stick with me. I'll tell you about it.
Be fun, know it in my heart, feel it in my gut about you. Forget I've ever been hurt. Forget the reasons why. Forget that I'm on earth. When I start looking at the sky, I'm feeling something coming up. I'm a different person. Don't know that what's knowing in my heart. Feel it in my gut about you.
To Garden Party on X-Ray FM. That was Fatal Optimist by Matty Diaz. Also coming to town on the 14th of November. What is this wealth of amazing live music that we have? So if you were with us before the break, you heard part of an interview with fellow OSU Master Gardener Ron Spendahl. And we were talking about mason bees. And I'm really bummed that it got cut off. But hey, this is the beauty of live radio, right? You can't get mistakes on a podcast, y'all. And look at this. We learn from our mistakes. We learn. We survive, don't we? But you missed the best part of the interview. And that was the difference between honeybees, which we said are not native, and mason bees. And the cool thing is how they collect pollen. So if you've ever looked closely at a honeybee or a bumblebee, which of course I recommend because that's kind of the best meditation there is, you've seen that they sort of collect pollen on their thighs. They sort of turn it into this little bit of a paste and it sticks back there. Mason bees don't do that. Mason bees use their entire body and the pollen sort of sticks in their little fluff in their little hairs and they don't create a paste. And what this means is that they are much more effective pollinators because as they go from plant to plant, that pollen is less stuck to them. So they can be up to 100 times more effective than a honeybee at pollinating. You know, we're thinking like 12 pounds of cherries, one mason bee can pollinate that on their own. So much, much more effective. And that's why mason bees do matter. That's why people, you might be hearing about them. I'm not going to say honeybees don't matter. They play an important role. All bees matter. But mason bees are just an incredible, incredible pollinating powerhouse. And if you are trying to grow anything or you care about things growing, They're good to have around. Now, I got one more question that came in on the text line, and I've only got time for this one, but it was, you know, as we're shutting down the garden for the winter, this person got behind on deadheading their perennials. Should they leave behind the seed heads for the spring? And this is what I was talking about. I really recommend that you do for a few reasons. One, there's really no rush. You can absolutely cut back those perennials in the springtime, and that will be fine for your plant. But what it will be great for is any birds that might feast on those seed heads and any beneficial insects that might nest in either the stems, in the leaves, in maybe even the seed heads that you're leaving behind. So I recommend you put that off until the spring and find something else to do. Now, before we wrap up this episode of Garden Party, I've got to give a big shout out to those Garden Party listeners who contributed to X-Ray's Fall Pledge Drive. You're the best. Lauren in Oregon City, Lynn in Albuquerque, New Mexico, John in Foster Powell, Dan in Los Angeles, Christine in Northeast Portland, Kate in Bridal Mile, Amy in Denver. Thank you for keeping radio yours and ours. I love you. X-Ray is community radio, and that means we can't do it without community. So thank you, thank you, thank you for anyone out there who joined us as a member. And it's never too late, y'all. You can still get that sweet, sweet merch at xray.fm. I'm Megan McMillan. I'm an Oregon State University Extension Master Gardener Volunteer. If you've got questions I didn't get to today, good news. You can get in touch with a Master Gardener Volunteer at metromastergardeners.org. We'll answer your questions anytime. That's what we love to do. You've got Friends of Noise coming up next, so keep it dialed to X-Ray. Radio's yours. Have an awesome Monday, y'all.
A garden party to reminisce with my old friends, a chance to share old memories and play our songs again. When I got to the garden party, they all knew my name. No one recognized me, I didn't look the same. But it's all right now, learned my lesson well. You see, you can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself. And people came from miles around, everyone was there. Yoko brought a walrus, there was magic in the air. And over in the corner, much to my surprise, Mr. Hughes hidden Dylan's shoes, wearing his disguise. But it's all right now, I learned my lesson well. You see, you can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself. Songs, I thought that's why they came. No one heard the music, we didn't look the same. I said hello to Mary Lou, she belongs to me. When I sang a song about a honky tonk, it was time to leave. But it's all right now, I learned my lesson well. You can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself. La-da-da, la-da-da-da, la-da-da-da. Someone opened up a closet door, and out stepped Johnny B. Goode, playing guitar like a ringing a bell, like you should. You gotta play at garden parties, I wish you a lot of luck. But if memories were all I sang, I'd rather drive a truck. But it's all right now, I
learned my lesson well. You see, you can't please.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from North Coast Pinball, Nehalem's Little Pinball Sanctuary, located on Highway 101 next to North Coast Mudworks. North Coast Pinball offers monthly tournaments and a selection of games from the 1970s to the present. Learn more at northcoastpinball.com.
Family Skill Builders keeps Oregon families together. Every day, they educate, mentor, empower, and advocate for